Over the years, I've asked myself the question, what would happen if the visitors actually showed up in a very public way? What changes would take place? What are we looking at when we see what's happening around us? We are looking at the outcome of somebody's attempt to alter the human species. This is what evolution looks like when it's applied to a conscious mind. I think it could happen.
Hold on, somebody at the door. Yeah, yeah. I'm actually busy. Okay. Yeah, so, but while you were talking, I did have one realization, which that is a very key point in the piece, and that is the difference between de-eroticization and desexualization. So somebody can be de-eroticized without being desexualized. Like porn is a great example for that. Porn is, in my estimation, and the terms that I'm using, is devoid of eroticism. So the libido is still present, and it has to be channeled, it has to be harnessed in some way, but in a way that isn't actually truly erotic, that doesn't allow for a deep connection to one's body and an embodiment of being. That's kind of my sense of what erotic experience is. It's not actually exclusively sexual, and sexual experience can be devoid of eroticism.
Well, that's really interesting. Let's stick with this for a moment longer, or as long as we want. I can see that the erotic is something different from just straight ahead sexuality. It seems obvious. Well, if you watch porn, one of the things about porn is that the characters in porn are really cartoonish and shallow. There's no chance for any kind of narrative development in a porn movie. There's no There are no characters that you can really fully identify with. It's sort of animalistic.
More machine-like, even.
Well, machine-like or animals? Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I it depends on how you view animals as to whether you think it's animalistic or machine-like. But yes, I can see what you're talking about. What's missing from just that kind of from pornography is subjectivity. The feeling that there are people who have ideas and self-conception, and that they're trying to work out their desires, that they seem to be just kind of, they're more like zombies, maybe somewhere between the animal and the machine.
Yeah.
So I definitely understand what you're getting at, but on the other hand, I just not quite sure. I don't think you can separate the sexual from the erotic completely. And there is something machine-like in eroticism, even, I think. So I'm just kind of trying to figure out where I stand.
Well, yeah, it's definitely gone straight to the nub of things, haven't we?
Yeah.
And it is central, I think it's central to Whitley Strieber and whatever's going on with him, and it's definitely central to this piece. And it is the kind of the first theme that I introduce, which is the idea of de-eroticized spirituality, what that is and what it looks like and what the reasons would be for it. Mm-hmm. So then, yeah, what is eroticism? Is that would need to be the first question to be answered. And as I kind of more intuitively than academically see it, Eros, the god of love, relates to the life force. So I see eroticism as a kind of response to the life force and an expression of the life force. It doesn't have to be through sexuality, much less through the genitals, but it can be, and that seems to be the most powerful and the most fully embodied expression of eros. But it could also be through dance, it could be through singing, it could be through conversation, it could be through walking in nature. I think it could be through not absolutely anything, because there's Thanatos, right? There's the flip side, or the antagonist of that energy, where, so I mean, war can't really be erotic, I don't think, whereas war can be sexualized, and I think it often is, like the My Lai massacre and the incidents that we've heard about where war becomes really kind of pathological, not that it isn't to begin with, but those particular incidents where it seems like there's a really kind of dark sexual element of sadism, mm-hmm. that would be an example of sexuality totally separated from eros that actually comes out through violence. Mm-hmm. And I think porn, I mean, this is what the feminists would said for years, that pornography was a kind of violence against women. I think that that's related to this, that when one's life force is being kind of confined to just to the genitals. Freud talks about this. I'm not very up on Freud either. I get Freud through other sources, but what I've got through Norman Brown specifically, the genital organization, when the life force or when the libido becomes actually confined to and even imprisoned in the genitals, in a sense, so that the only way that we can experience sexual pleasure, and maybe any pleasure at all to some extent, is through the genitals, mm-hmm. as opposed to through the whole body. Initially, if you think about a child, an infant in the womb, like how much is it grounded in its body? How much is that awareness? Not at all, really. It's this amorphous consciousness that is overlapping with the mother's body, and who knows, you know, how diffuse that kind of consciousness is. But as the child grows, it's becoming more and more grounded in its body, and more it's required more and more to become, to identify with itself as a separate body.
Right. But Freud's story is that actually, you know, the original erotic experience with the mother is not one in which you say, I'm enjoying my mother's body. Mm-hmm. Because there's no distinction.
Right.
So I'm just enjoyment.
I think the awareness of the mother's body only comes about with the awareness of separation from it.
Right, even. Right. And that also means that the awareness of yourself,
mm-hmm.
only comes about after separation.
Yeah, so I think there is inevitably a traumatic element to it. I just think of it's how, if there's a space, a sufficient space for that trauma to not be overwhelming for the child, then I think it doesn't lead to the pathology that we're describing. But I think that that doesn't happen. I think it invariably is overwhelmingly traumatic, and so a certain degree of sexual pathology develops.
I don't think there's any way to avoid it being traumatic. I mean,
well, that's what I'm saying. I think it has to be somewhat traumatic, just as birth has to be somewhat traumatic. Any kind of sort of individual existence requires separation from the whole, so that's a split, and so there's an element of trauma in any sort of split, I think.
Right.
The word trauma may even mean split. I'm not even sure. It sounds like it has something to do with it, because you talk about bodily traumas. I think it's a sort of unknown gray area to at what point does trauma become crippling.
Well, right. I mean, it absolutely can, right? I mean, that's it can be devastating, and it's the source of all, according to Freud, it's the source of our various mental illnesses, is this attempt to deal with trauma, the trauma really of just existence, because to exist as an individual person, you have to have suffered this trauma.
Absolutely, but then it begs the question, what's going on with the animals? I mean, the rest of nature's dealing with the trauma fine, right? But we're not.
Are they? I
It's
mean,
questionable. Yeah, it is questionable, actually. We have a tendency to idealize the natural world, I think, but.
I don't know. I mean, I think I've dealt with animals, and some of them are real shits.
We're talking about domesticated animals.
No. The ones I really dislike are possums. Those fuckers.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, they're not. There's nothing to admire there.
Well, no, I wasn't suggesting admirable exactly, but it's a fair point. I mean, how do we know? It just seems like, so far as if we're going to start faulting nature, then what's the comparison point? What can you compare nature to as being
Well,
the right way?
right. Well, see, here's what I'm saying. Like, if you, one of the things that you discover about your mother, once you've separated, is that she's broken too.
Yeah.
She's been traumatized as well, and the father has also been traumatized as well. And that the reality is that there was never an unbroken existence, really.
Well, we can't go far enough back to say never, can we? We just
Well,
say we don't know where it is or what it looked like. There's no not much evidence for it.
I don't know. If you think that you have to find empirical evidence for something in order to know something, then we can't go far enough back. But if you look, if you can use reason to see a structure, then you might be able to say this structure seems permanent. I mean, this logic. The logic of the necessity of trauma and separation seems to be intrinsic to biological existence, say, and to conscious existence. And so that as long as there have been conscious entities, that there has also been trauma.
Yeah, so framing trauma as a negative per se is not the way to go.
Well, right. I mean,
So, but identifying trauma isn't the same as framing as a negative. And I think we live, I mean, my impression is that we're kind of a species in denial of trauma.
Oh yeah, I agree. And one of the things that this fetish quality of modern sexuality it points to is our denial of the trauma, because we keep thinking, oh well, we can find it. We can find our mother again if we could just get the right shoelaces in our nose or something, if we just roll up the bread the right way, Mama will come back to us. And
Right, or if we worship the right gods and do the right rituals.
exactly, same thing. And so yeah, that I agree that that's like we're definitely in a dis we are disavowing or denying our trauma. But I think that it's really easy to think that we can to end up doing that again. I think that if we, for instance, in your book, you're writing about how heaven is simply the harmony of consciousness with the body, and you're aiming at trying to bring that harmony back. But what I would say is that you have to if you're not going to disavow the trauma, you're going to have to abandon this idea of harmony, because consciousness doesn't exist as something that's in harmony. Consciousness exists as something discordant, something decentered, something
Well,
separated.
that doesn't really follow though, because harmony, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this. Like if there wasn't such thing as harmony, there wouldn't be such a thing as disharmony.
Right. Let me think about yeah. Okay. If there wasn't such a thing as harmony, there wouldn't be such a thing as disharmony. True enough. But understanding the distinction requires disharmony.
Well, let me put it this way, because I think this might be a case of where we could go about it the wrong way and disagree for half an hour and then find out that we're agreeing.
Okay.
Like in the psychological model and my own experience, the idea of being at harmony in one's body, or there being harmony between one's consciousness or one's awareness and one's body, that focus in itself is contingent on, inseparable from, an awareness of the disharmony. So the more closely I look at my own present state of consciousness, my own present state of disharmony with my body, the more that's allowing me to follow those sort of lines of disharmony, if you will, outside and inside, to this trauma that's in my past. So then the closer I'm getting to the trauma, the more intensely I'm feeling the disharmony between my consciousness and my body, let's say. Right? But I do see that as, I do see that there's an end. I don't know about an end in sight, but there's at least an end in mind, if you will. There's the possibility there of an eventual harmony that comes out of that recognition of trauma, not because the trauma will disappear by recognizing it, but because of all the disharmony that's brought about through the denial of the trauma will be relieved, because I won't be putting all of this stress and effort into denying something. I'll actually allow the trauma to come fully into awareness, and then I'll become fully aware of this disharmony that I'm talking about. And paradoxically, I would say that that is harmony, that a full awareness of the disharmony is the only kind of harmony that we'll ever experience.
Well, I want to tell you a story about what's been going on with me lately, which is I kind of feel like I've been going through a midlife crisis.
I got that feeling.
I had a I have a book coming out, and my publisher asked me to get a more professional looking photo taken, one that wasn't a selfie. A selfie is when you use your own like cell phone or something to take your picture.
Oh, all right.
And the great thing about a selfie is that it's like looking into the mirror, so you can adjust yourself to be exactly as distorted as you like and then take the picture. And of course, for me, you know, there are certain things I want to do, is like not show the lines of my face and not show my true width. My hairline is okay. Okay. That's not my problem, but my width is my weight. I would try to look thinner than I am and things like that. And so you can control that. But what you can't end up controlling is the fact that you might have to not smile so that people don't see your cheeks expanding. And, so you look kind of weird in these selfies, but it's the weirdness you like. So anyway, my publisher didn't like how I looked in my selfies, so he made me go out and get someone to take a real picture of me. And it looked like me. It looked, very respectable. It looked just like me. And I hated it. Oh, my God, I really am 42. Probably people wonder if I'm 50. This is... I'm getting old. And I'm not where I want to be. And I, start taking your stock of your whole life and saying to yourself, yeah, living like a slob and, off of very little money, when you're 29 and, struggling to get ahead as an artist is one thing. At 42, it's completely something else. And, so I had this experience and the reason I bring it up is because it made me think about aging and to read about aging. And one of the things about aging is that it's the result of your body working. Your metabolism, as it keeps going, just does a little bit of damage just to live. There's DNA damage, there's cellular damage, just through the process of living. And when you're young, just a little bit of damage doesn't matter. But over time, the damage accumulates, and it gets more and more severe, and you start getting sick. So the things we associate with aging really is the failure of the body, the damage that the body is suffering through living. And there's this guy, Aubrey de Grey, who says, "I want to fix this." He's a biologist and doctor, and mm-hmm. I think we should treat it like a disease. I think right. we can repair the cells. We can undo the damage at certain points in people's lives. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I think that, so I don't know if I, you know, believe that's going to happen, but if it could happen, I've decided that I would support that. I think that would be a good thing, that I'm not really sure that I think that often what we think of as the release of our problems or getting over the damage we're doing to ourselves is actually just death, the end. And what health would be is to undo some of the damage and set it up so you can continue to damage yourself in the future. to fix yourself up so that you can take it some more.
Well, what's the end goal? Immortality or what?
Well, health.
Health.
Metabolism.
Are you feeling unhealthy besides your photograph?
Well, no, okay, you're right. I'm not feeling unhealthy necessarily, but I'm not feeling as healthy as you start to notice, you know, when you're like, oh, you know, I do have some aches and pains. My shoulder hurts sometimes. And I started going for long walks to try to shed a few pounds, and I'm realizing, oh, yeah, you know what? You walk 6 miles and it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it wouldn't have hurt it would not hurt at 29. If it, even the same condition you're in now, you could have just gotten up and gone, no problem. At 42. Yeah, you actually, there's, you know. So, am I feeling unhealthy? Not so much. But am I feeling like I would like to be in better physical condition? Absolutely. But, so, for me, acceptance of my aging is meaning that I want to repair some of the damage that's done rather than to embrace the damage and hope to end it, because ending it would mean the grave, I think.
There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. When I hear that trumpet sound, I'm gonna rise right out of the ground. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, look way down the river, and what do you think I see? I see a band of angels, and they're coming after me. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, look down yonder, Gabriel. Put your feet on the land and sea. But Gabriel, don't you blow your trumpet till you hear from me. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, meet me, Jesus, meet me. Meet me in the middle of the air. And if these wings don't fail me, I will meet you anywhere. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, meet me, mother and father. Meet me down the river road. And mama, you know that I'll be there when I check in, my Lord. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down.
Gosh, there's a lot I mean, there's a lot of different responses to that.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the one thing, maybe we could get to that after, because it might spiral off into a whole thing, is the whole transhumanist thing, which is, the, as you notice, one of the subjects of this current work, trauma transformation and transhumanism. And so what you're describing there is edging off into that area, and I have very strong feelings about that. But before, if we do go into that, maybe I should give my own case as a counterpoint to yours, which is that I'm 46, just turned 46. I got those crucial 4 years on you. I've been through, like, since I turned 40, I mean, I've just been through an awful lot. You probably noticed here and there. I mean, I got married for one thing. That's pretty big. My mother died. My brother died. I've had sciatica kicked in a couple of years ago, and that's been quite severe for the last couple of years. So there's been this combination of emotional, mental, and physical distress, let's say, not necessarily trauma. My sense is, picking up from what I said before, that this is actually an inevitable side effect. Well, it feels much more than just a side thing, but an inevitable effect of actually being willing to look at and see areas of my psyche that I wasn't willing to look at and see, speaking metaphorically now, but whatever, to go into certain areas of my past, and that's, you know, it's been stirring this stuff up in my body, and I'm experiencing it as somatic. So I can't, while I identify with what you're saying totally, I can't actually kind of side with it. Like, I mean, I'm in, I would say, more of an acute position than yourself, in that my back really is quite bad, and I'm going to yoga now, and it's quite distressing going to yoga because I can barely bend, and the yoga teachers who are in their 70s and in great shape are constantly kind of expressing their horror at my condition and saying that, you know, they've never seen such a severe case before. And this is something I would have not been aware of before. Of course, I was aware of my sciatic pain, but I wasn't really aware of the fact that I can't touch my toes, because when do you need to touch your toes, right?
Right.
But now it's in this context of actually addressing it and facing the fact that if I don't deal with it now, it's just going to keep getting worse. So the whole idea of aging is no longer, abstract or academic, and it's no longer just a vanity thing about my hairline or my waistline. Mm-hmm. And you have to worry about the former, by the way, but it actually is. I'm actually feeling old, and I'm feeling like I have a condition now that only death is going to cure, basically. Right. I'm not going to get in better shape. I can maybe stave off this so I don't get in worse shape. I can hope that there is something to what my wife said, that she did group therapy and she saw people who actually went into past trauma and relived, in quotes, it doesn't mean they actually relived the memories, but they allowed the memory, the body memory, to come back into awareness, which I've had limited experience of. And she said that she saw 10 years fall away in a matter of hours. She said that their faces changed, and they actually lost 10 years as a result of that. And I it sounds incredible, but at the same time, I don't really have a reason to doubt that. My wife says it. Mm-hmm. She looks very young. She's older than me, but she's barely got a line on her face. So I think, to me, they really are inseparable. And the idea, inseparable, that, getting old means allowing oneself to bring into awareness one's past trauma and actually integrate it, and that does involve a degree of physical distress and breakdown. And that, so the aging process that you're describing, the damage and the wear and tear, my feeling, and this isn't a biological or scientific perspective, but my sort of felt sense, is that is largely due to the stress of denial and of repressing trauma. And so to then start looking for pills and nanotechnologies and whatever other things we can turn to as a way to fix the problem without actually addressing it, to override it and bypass it, is not the way to go.
Okay, but my question is, what are we in denial of?
I think that the trauma, like this, we've got the idea of trauma as original split, the inevitable trauma, which is birth, let's say. Let's use the obvious example that we can all agree on. That is an inevitable trauma because we have to be split off from the mother's body. Mm-hmm. But then I think we've got the trauma that is avoidable, but that we don't avoid, which is the split that comes about in our own psyche due to an inability, which isn't our fault because it's circumstantial. The environment that we're born and raised into doesn't provide us with the structures to deal with the necessary trauma. And so we deal with it the only way we know how, which is by dissociating, which is by splitting the psyche through an inner kind of violence. And that protects us and preserves us. It's necessary, I think. We wouldn't survive as infants if we weren't able to do this. But I don't say literally, I hate people use that word, but it figuratively splits us off at a psychic level so that we compartmentalize the trauma and file it away somewhere. And our awareness becomes confined in this constructed identity, which is safe from the trauma, from experiencing a similar kind of trauma, but also in that moment of trauma, on that period of trauma, from actually fully experiencing the trauma as it's happening. And so I think what happens then is that the split, the figurative split in the psyche, which is, we don't really know what the psyche is, there's a more literal or tangible kind of split in the body, whereby our life force gets, or our libido gets blocked, it gets shut down in some way. So the trauma goes into the body because we're not able to actually fully experience it, and it gets trapped in the body, and then that trapped trauma prevents the life force from flowing through and into the body. And so then the denial is, it's not a denial of this never happened, it's that initial denial or dissociation rather that protected us from the trauma, but that prevented the trauma from actually being released by the body, and so then it's trapped. So the only way to clear that out is to re-experience the trauma, to actually allow it to come back into awareness bodily, not necessarily through hypnosis or through remembering what happened. I think it just happens naturally if we allow ourselves to put our attention on, well, first of all, the body. I mean, again, to cite myself as a counterexample to yourself, I'm, you know, my health is not good. I mean, it's been better the last few years, despite, you know, not the sciatica notwithstanding. But since I've been working on this piece, the Prisoner of Infinity piece project, it's got worse. I mean, it's really, and I can only attribute that to the fact that I am working through this material, and so it's stuff is getting stirred up in my body. I mean, that's my optimistic outlook.
Well, let me ask you: when you say your health isn't good, other than that sciatica, that's a nerve problem, right?
So,
other than the pain in your back because of a pinched nerve, what are your other symptoms? I mean, are you lethargic or depressed?
Yeah, the easiest way to sort of encapsulate the symptoms is the chronic fatigue ME thing. So then that's lethargy, exhaustion, heaviness, muscle pains, body aches. And it does, it so overlaps with emotional states that I can't actually separate the two. Like if I have these symptoms, I feel depressed, and if I feel depressed, I have the symptom. It's all one sort of continuous pole.
How did you feel when you were working on the gold digging project?
Much better. Yeah, much better. Yeah.
And you were getting out, right? And walking and
I do get out still and I'm playing tennis and I walk, and but it's not the same as actually spending hours out there digging in the dirt. It's one's fully, I mean, one's body is one's reality largely. I mean, I'm still thinking, of course, but right. the thoughts are just kind of noise going on while I'm focusing on what I'm doing, as opposed to when I'm writing and working on a piece where the thoughts are actually part of the doing.
Well, have you been spending more time sitting and more time working on the computer and things?
Of course, yeah. And you could attribute it to that.
Right. But I tend to not completely attribute to that, but I tend to think that, you know, your body is going to feel better when it's out exercising, especially when you have back pain, and it's going to feel worse.
Absolutely. But I don't think you can separate the two things, because it's kind of the quality of awareness. It's not just that the body wants this physical activity, it's what happens to the mind when we're physically engaged with our environment, as opposed to when we're sitting at a computer. Because the mind gets in that very sort of focused, confined, and it is more, I don't want to use the word egotistical, but I don't want to fumble for a better one, but I don't want to give it a wholly negative thing, but it's more identity based. And when I'm out there digging in the dirt, I can't be thinking, oh, this is really, you know, going to make me in the world, or this is really going to improve my standing in the world, or any of that stuff, right? It doesn't actually have any meaning in terms of my status or my self-image.
Right.
It really doesn't. And so that's like meditation, or in its pure sense, the supposed benefits of a meditative or a monastic lifestyle. I have experienced out there digging, you know, looking for gold. Ironic, because it's such an obviously materialist pursuit.
Right, but not one you expected to really find great rewards.
Exactly, yeah. No, I'm not in it for the gold.
Right. I can't help but think about this Hegel chapter that I just read, where he talks about how we get trapped by our need for pleasure. And I want to just walk you through how he says we get there and see if this relates to what we've been talking about at all. Especially because you brought up, you know, you end up sitting and you can't separate your physical feeling from your mental feelings. I agree with that completely. And you end up sitting there, and this I identify with, working on some project that you think, I will finally have social standing if this just works.
Yeah.
You know, right? And I know that. I know that really well. So for Hegel, he doesn't have this story about Oedipus and the mother and the baby at the beginning. He is more abstract, but his starting point is that we start with sense certainty, which I think correlates to this idea of being whole and being connected to the mother. We start with, we experience the world and we are sure of it. That's just sense certainty. But what happens is we immediately understand that we become to understand through sensing the world and thinking about it, that we know the world only as it is for us and not as it is in itself, that we can't be confident about the world as we know it. And, you know, there are various reasons that we might point to explain why we become less than confident about our senses and our perceptions. Like, you know, you put a stick into a puddle and it appears to bend, but it isn't really bent.
Mm-hmm.
So something's different than what you actually perceive there. So what we do then, as we come to understand that there's the world as it is, and then there's the world as it is for us, as we try to take ourself as an object, to try to figure out what is this thing that's doing the perceiving. And once we do that, we lose hold of ourselves. We immediately become an object again, outside of ourselves. And we can never actually grab hold of what it is that's really doing the perceiving.
Right.
So then this leads us to something like what René Girard talks about, this attempt to find other people who will verify our experiences for us. People we assume are self-conscious like we are, but are more whole than we are.
Right.
So they have what we lack, and so we go to them to not to support them and push them up, but really to say, if you verify me, that means I really am all that is real.
A validation.
Yeah. Because what we're seeking is not to just be a mere object, but we want to be the source of all reality, because that's kind of our experience,
yeah.
And we want to be confident in that experience. So,
right.
All right. So this leads to a point where you just try to grab hold of the world and experience it for your own individual pleasure, according to Hegel. You're constantly actually trying to enjoy the separation and make that separation something that is yours. And that is, because that is what defines reality, so you want to define reality, and so that's how you you try to become reality, is by grabbing that sense of separation and taking it as your own. And you get off on that.
It's making me think of my brother, to say.
Right. So, all right. So this is, now the next step in the phenomenology is called heart, I think. Or I think it has to do with love. It's an alternative to just the necessity of pleasure. But when I heard you saying that if we could get over our denial, then we could kind of work through our trauma. It seemed to me you were conflating the denial of the trauma with the trauma, that you were trying to say that separation is me. If I can just stop denying it, then I'll be whole. Because that separation is what defines reality. And really, I do that. So if I can just stop denying this trauma, then I can become the trauma myself. I can be whole and complete, and I think that there's got to be something else than doing that. here's another reason, another example of what goes wrong with that. Have you ever watched the show Doctor Who?
Well, I did as a kid.
Okay. Do you remember the fourth Doctor, the Tom Baker Doctor?
Yeah.
He's my favorite Doctor.
John Pertwee was my favorite.
All right.
Well, Tom Baker came along just when I was still watching it, so yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, I started watching it with Tom Baker. I think it just depends on who you started with.
Is who your favorite is. Yeah, of course.
But Tom Baker was this kind of bohemian outsider who would go from one planet to another, one time period to another, and have these little adventures. And no one took him to be very important at first. I mean, he would land on this planet and he would be a stranger, and only through the course of the story did he come to be any kind of heroic person, and did people slowly start to take him seriously. He was kind of like Columbo.
Right.
You know, Columbo will walk up and he's this little schlub of a man and no one takes him seriously, but over time he figures out the crime, and then you have to take him seriously.
Yeah, it's the power of being underestimated.
Right. Whereas in the new Doctor Who, I don't know if you've seen it, the new Doctor Who, when he lands on a planet, everyone already knows who he is. His name is like the name of God. The Doctor is known everywhere, and he is legendary. And often enough, you know, the story will revolve around whether or not he's going to die, or because that will, if he dies, it will destroy the universe or something.
Right.
So... Huh. The problem that in the old Tom Baker episodes, the problem wasn't Tom Baker's problem. He was an outsider to the problem. He just arrived and kind of worked on it. In the new Doctor Who, this Doctor Who himself is the trauma that's traveling around. He's like always causing the universe to explode everywhere he goes. He's too much for everything. And
right, it's rather like Whitley Strieber, actually, what you're describing.
Right. Okay. So it seems to me that the original show, as bad as the old special effects were, and as kind of long-winded as that show could be, because they had to pace it, you know, in little 20-minute segments over time, it was still a better program, and it reflected a more confidence in the world than what we've got now, where we're trying, Matt Smith is trying to be the trauma, be the perfect doctor, and you know, really embody the paradoxes of the show in himself, and it just, it goes wildly wrong, and the show has to cheat all the time. So anyway, I'm just kind of pointing at the sketch of what I'm getting at, because I don't quite know what I believe as to what the solution would be. Sometimes I think we should grab that trauma and take it on as our own.
But it seems like the middle way is what's being called or summoned here, doesn't it? Because denial of trauma doesn't work, but identification with trauma is just, you know, it's just a kind of constant re-traumatization thing, which I think one of the things I've discovered while looking into Whitley Strieber is that there is this tendency to, I think this is what you're describing, to identify with the trauma and actually to be constantly re-traumatizing instead of, or in lieu of, re-experiencing the original trauma.
Right. And that's also a good explanation as to if you, I kind of get the sense from Whitley Strieber, is it Strieber or Strieber?
Strieber,
yeah. Whitley's, I get the sense from Whitley Strieber that he's kind of egomaniacal and very kind of sensitive to criticism.
He is definitely the latter. I wouldn't want to put the former on him or anyone really, because he was without sin and all that.
Right, well, I'm definitely egomaniacal, but I can relate to Strieber in that way. But he's developed this, there's almost like a saintly quality to him that is being
pushed. Absolutely, yeah. Well, he's very guru-like. I mean, he platforms and he pontificates and he proselytizes and he preaches. It's very overt about that. Sure, that's definitely...
So I think that's part and parcel to this trying to seize the trauma as your own.
Yeah, I think so too. Becoming a legend in one's own time.
And that, paradoxically, that trying to seize the trauma as your own is a way of denying the trauma.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly that point.
Yeah. So, where should we go from here? I feel I've got to go pretty soon because I got to walk to work, but in about 45 minutes here, and I want to take a shower first, but...
Okay. But, how long have we been on?
An hour. Hmm. Just about an hour. But do you feel like... we're agreeing now, and I know, so...
so you run out of things to say.
But, yeah.
Well, I don't know. You were getting to something interesting, or maybe we got there. I think you were pointing out...
Yeah, like, I think that for you, it's like... maybe you should just take note if you're feeling bad sitting at the computer and working on these, working your way through these problems, that actually you're not going to be able to like get to a point where the pain is so great it's going to go away.
No, I know. Absolutely. I mean, it's a fine line. I mean, you mentioned that the title Pleasure and Necessity, that's a principle I've lived by as well, enjoyment and necessity, and make sure it's either one or the other, and preferably both. But to kind of know, yeah, when something is becoming compulsive, when it's no longer, if it's no longer not enjoyable, then it better be necessary, right? So this process with exploring Strieber, was absolutely, it took over. I mean, I wasn't expecting to embark upon it at all. It just happened very organically and spontaneously. So there's a feeling of just being carried away by something. Mm-hmm. And that always feels good. And then it really took over. Like my every available minute was dedicated to it. And then it started feeling like it was becoming compulsive and it was becoming less enjoyable. But that was coinciding with the period of actually finishing it up as a written piece. And now I'm moving into this next phase, which I hope is going to be more enjoyable, which I see as not just an art project, but as a kind of therapeutic thing where, you know me, I see everything in that way. Uh-huh. But I mean, in terms of who I'm talking to and what we're talking about, I hope that it's going to, like we've done today, be an opportunity for people to actually explore those areas that do need to be explored without, I mean, I know my tendency is not just to find the wound and check the wound, but just keep poking in there so it never has a chance to heal. Right. I do recognize that about myself, but that doesn't mean I don't appreciate somebody pointing it out.
Well, I mean, I think the reason we all do that is because we get off on that.
Sure.
You know, because we it is pleasurable. The thing to realize is that you actually, when Hegel is talking about the pleasure and necessity, he actually thinks those two things are locked together.
Right.
That there's a feeling anyway, the self-consciousness gets to a point where it feels that what is most pleasurable is seeking what's necessary. And not what's necessary, like, you know, what happens to be good for you, but like what is absolutely rock solid, the necessity for mm-hmm. there to be an existence. It's like that seeking of to repair that split is what just drives the self-consciousness, and that is a way, that is a form of pleasure, because it's a way of taking oneself to be the split, and to say I am it. It verges on a solipsistic kind of. I mean, they never.
Right. Well, I mean, but I think we shadow the real, don't we? Like my brother again. He was trying to get to and express something real, but he ended up becoming lost in his own shadow, I think, which is what we all do to greater or lesser extent.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're describing of Hegel, in the sense I get that he's meaning it in a really truly positive life enhancing sense, is in get whatever it is, if we find what is necessary to us, that will fully engage our life force in the doing of it, and then we will then be fully engaged with our life force.
Well, one thing I find really interesting about this conversation is that it's supposed to be about Whitley Strieber, and we haven't mentioned aliens once.
That's right.
So I mentioned them now, and yeah. We don't have to mention them again. A lot of the times what I try to do is I try to put all of this into some sort of political context, because I find that compelling. And I'll do that now. What I've been working on with online and things and arguing with people about online is how we could possibly get out from under the current economic and political system and create something better. And there's kind of, I think, two minds about how to do that. There's this approach that says we need to get back to nature, back to real life. And then there's my approach, which is we need to fuck up in a new and better way. We need to accept that we're not going to get it right, but try something new.
Well, I think there's plenty of people doing that, preparing to fuck up in new ways.
I don't know. I think we keep fucking up the same way. But I mean, I think that we do varieties of the same thing.
Well, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But I think that's, as long as we're driven by those infantile patterns, I think that's always going to be the case, because you've got religion, you've got science, you've got art, you've got magic. They're all really being sort of variations on the same theme, I think.
Yeah. Well, I just recently had a guy named John Zerzan on one of my podcasts. You know who he is?
Have you heard of him?
He's an American primitivist. And his idea is that what went wrong, the reason we have a bad society, is because we let agriculture take hold. And we became separated from the earth and tried to control it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, a bit late now, isn't it?
So, right. So he wants to return to a hunter-gatherer lifestyle.
I know, I'm sure you got plenty to argue about with him then.
yes, I did. But I went slow, and we ended up agreeing by the end that maybe what I pointed out to him was that what he was assuming was that there was a right way to live, and that these hunter-gatherer people who we'd never met but only thought about and read about had it, and that we could somehow figure out the right way to live. But the danger there is once you think you have the right way to live, that's the most ideological thing you can
have. Absolutely, yeah. I'm really congenitally opposed to offering solutions. I'm a problem guy. I just like to lay out the problems and really see what's wrong. And I'm a hopeless optimist too. I have this sense that if we actually really fully see the state of things, our trauma, our psyche, all the rest of it, then that it will take care of itself.
I'm with you. I'm a problem guy. And what I want, when I say we should fuck up in a new way, it's like, I want a new problem. We should like focus on some kind of new problem. Like a creative world where our problems aren't starvation and the threat of war, but
I think we've got one. I do. I think, well, hopefully you will find something stimulating in this current piece, because I think it's probably the most political writing that I've done. I see it as a political piece. I wouldn't describe it that way, but I am now. I mean, because it's, I mean, as you know, I've been a spiritual seeker or a mystic and all of those things my whole life, and I'm beginning to really see it through a much more political lens as a problem, as all of that is really a part of the problem. And I think it's always been there, the root of the problem, the kind of religious instinct. But I think it's coming into full form now. Like we're nearing a sort of religious revival, scientism is what you call it, scientific religion. It's not really scientific, right. But.
I will say that everything else we talked about is the same, I think, as my original point, just in different terms, which is that we think that if you want to elevate erotic, that's fine, but we think that we are being suppressed in our sexuality, but our sexuality as we know it now often involves enjoying how we're suppressed, enjoying right. how we're being held back, figuring out a way to make that trauma us. And so I think a break from the work that we do now would mean giving up on who we think we are getting rid of stopping ourselves from getting off on not being who we want to be.
Yeah, you know? What did that mean? I don't know.
Well, like we have these visions of who we want to be.
Yeah.
And what they really are for is to help us be who we are. They're like, I want to be the great writer. Yeah. That way I can continue to be the impoverished telemarketer. You know, that's what it's. So if I really wanted to change, the first thing to do would be to say, I'm not
that thing.
I'm not trying for being a great writer and like fully identify with what I am. And then probably pretty soon I won't be able to take it. Right. So, So then I'll have to do something else and figure out some other thing that I'll try to be and some other thing that I'm settling for. Right. So at least that's, I think, what I want to do.
I know we have to wind up, and this isn't a winding up comment, but I guess it'll have to be. But I think, you know, what everyone wants to be is powerful, and what everyone feels like is a victim is powerless. And we have created a culture through Christianity, I think, and Sherrard writes about this, where the victim is the most powerful role to take.
Right.
And that's what you're saying, identifying with the trauma, which of course is Jesus. Jesus is trauma, you know, on legs.
And then that's really interesting that you said that. I do need to go, but I can't let this lie, because René Girard says the thing about Christianity and about Christ is that he's innocent.
Yeah.
So he isn't the trauma.
Right, but he's a symbol of it.
Yeah, but we misunderstand him if we think of him as, according to Girard, we misunderstand him if we think of him as something that stands in for the trauma.
Well, how so? Because an innocent, a child that's traumatized is also innocent.
Right, but, well, I guess if when we identify him with the trauma, we let the trauma define him. It's like he's trying, like it's like I've been describing how we kind of are responsible by seeking to be the trauma. We and enjoying that, we become somewhat responsible for our own problems, right?
Yeah.
And so Christ being innocent means that he's not doing that. He's not trying to become the trauma. He's not in any way responsible for what happened to him. So I think that's what... I mean, I had a critique of Girard, and I thought that maybe insisting upon Christ's innocence wasn't enough to get out from under the situation, to get out from under the scapegoating mechanism that he talks about. We can't just say, oh, well, Christ is innocent, therefore... Well,
apparently not. I mean, that's it didn't happen, did it?
No, it sure didn't. And Girard always like says, well, people just don't understand. If they only read my books, then this would all go away. But yeah. But I think what Girard was trying to get at is a way of dealing with this trauma, which doesn't set up the need to perpetuate it again.
Right, to have more victims. It seems to me like a sort of macrocosm of the, you know, the child who's abused that grows into the abuser, like how to prevent right. that cycle, that vicious cycle from
right.
constantly spinning.
You know, before I got on the phone with you, I just watched a little clip from Fight Club where it was called Jack's Smirking Revenge. Was mm-hmm. the way it was, and it's a moment where he's with his boss, and he's trying to blackmail and extort money from the boss, and he's about to get thrown out. So before he gets thrown out, he starts punching himself out,
and right,
beating
right.
himself up, and that's how he gets what he wants.
Right, by becoming the victim.
Right, by victimizing him, by taking on the responsibility for his trauma, and doing it to himself. So. Now I'm confused. I kind of, because so far I've been saying, "Oh, we shouldn't try to grab that trauma," but now I feel like we should. So I don't know.
I think that among the things that will happen, it's first it'll be very sudden. One moment, life will be like this. The next moment, they'll just be here. I mean, I don't think they're going to land. I think they're much more likely to walk out of your bedroom into your living room at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and than they are to land in a big flying saucer on the White House lawn. They have utter disdain for the material world. They're even a little afraid of being involved with it, the material world. They find it binding, something that weighs you down. And these dark blue figures were literally leaping around the room like acrobats, almost putting themselves on display. But what was happening in the basement was very, very different. And this is absolutely critical because it represents something that is completely commonplace in this experience. But here's the larger question. Who are they? Who are they?
They're gonna put it down. Right. Yeah.
But I do think this, I do think that very suddenly we will find ourselves essentially living in a completely new world. It'll be a different experience than we're having now, because all of a sudden we will not be time-bound anymore. The dead are not really dead. The dead are not really dead. But I have a feeling, for a lot of people, the darkness I experienced on that night is going to be what they see of the change. And frankly, I think there's going to be a total breakdown of economic structures. I think that a lot of people are going to go mad. I think in fear. And these dark blue figures were literally leaping around the room like acrobats, almost putting themselves on display. But what was happening in the basement was very, very different. But I have a feeling, for a lot of people, the darkness I experienced on that night is going to be what they see of the change. And frankly, I think there's going to be a total breakdown of economic structures. I think that a lot of people are going to go mad, I think with fear. I think it could happen.